Welcome to Season 2 of the Healthcare Fraud Shield podcast. Healthcare Fraud Shield is the leading provider of fraud, waste, and abuse detection software to healthcare payers. Our innovative suite of integrated products includes AI, prepayment, postpayment for both medical and pharmacy, case management, and a reporting tool. If you'd like more information about Healthcare Fraud Shield, please visit our website at www.hcfraudshield.com. Thank you for listening. Hi, welcome to the Healthcare Fraud Shield podcast. My name is Karen Weintraub, and today is episode 7 of season 2, and I am excited to announce my guest today, Eric Rubenstein. Eric is someone I've known for a long time. I'm going to let him introduce himself, and then I'm going to tell a quick little story about some of our first encounters in the fraud world. So, Eric, welcome.
Thanks for having me. And we do know each other a long time. It's probably 20 or 22 years, I'm guessing. But thanks for having me on. And for those listening, I am Eric Rubenstein. I'm the Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, and Abuse Support for Advise Health, which is an advisory and consulting company. We have a national footprint. We provide a variety of fraud, waste, abuse, and compliance services to the healthcare industry, both on the payer side, the provider side, litigation support for law firms. I came to Advise in January of 2019, after retiring as a senior special agent with the OIG for U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, where I was a criminal investigator for my whole career, predominantly working in New York and New Jersey. So I did criminal, civil, and administrative cases for the OIG.
Thank you. Yeah, you've had an impressive career. And so my quick little story of you, I don't even know if you remember this. So we worked a case, I referred it to OIG, when I was working as an investigator. It involved a family practice up in North Jersey. And I had the pleasure and the opportunity to join you on some interviews and part of the investigation. And what my recollection is of you is you are the most organized interviewer and note taker I have ever encountered in my life. You would take these copious notes, neatest handwriting, and then you would take every single page from your notebook and you would fold it up, put it underneath, and then you'd work on the next page. So the interviewee couldn't see your notes every single time. So every single page got folded in half. I don't know if you remember that or if you still do that now.
I do. So my handwriting, unfortunately, over 20 plus years, the more that I typed, the crappier my handwriting got, to a point where only I could read it. And it was basically in code. And I would have to go back and write up my interview reports almost immediately. They were about as contemporaneous as you can get because I couldn't read my handwriting afterwards. But yeah, for my whole career, I would actually do that. I would write a page of notes, number the page, pull the page off of the notebook, fold it, and put it between the last page and the cardboard of like an 8.5 by 11 notebook. I did that my whole career. In part, that was true. It was in part so that people that I was talking to didn't see my notes. It was also just a way to keep track of where the pages were, so I wasn't flipping pages or taking the chance of losing them. So I did that my whole career. I think a lot of people, when they get into a habit of doing something that they do in the field or whatever, you just sort of stick with it as time goes on. My handwriting did get atrocious though as time went on.
I think that's normal. Mine has as well.
Yeah, I mean, I would have trials where I had one trial in particular in 2014 where the defense attorney had my handwritten notes and my typed report and was kind of going page by page. And you know, the thing is, when you're doing these interview reports, the typed reports are sum and substance. It's not a verbatim recitation, and that would just be absurd. You know, what's the point then? And I remember the a couple of times the defense attorney going like page by page and trying to get me to find places where I wrote something down that was in the notes but wasn't necessarily in the written product. And there were some times where he said, you know, could you read this? And I said, no. And he's like, well, it's your handwriting. Well, I get it's my handwriting, but it's also from 4 years ago. If you look at the date that I wrote the report, it was the same day that I took the notes. And I did that because my handwriting got so bad over time that I couldn't even read what I wrote a week or 2 weeks, sometimes even a day later.
Yeah, it's important. We always talk about that when we do training. Contemporaneous notes should get typed up right away for that very reason.
Yeah, it's true. I teach for some of the SIUs, do a little block of instruction for SIUs. And one of the things that I put together, and we put it up on our little, be on our website soon for our training, is on interviewing and documentation. And what I found is that there's such a lack of consistency, just because people come from so many different experiences. Some of them have a past life in law enforcement. They did this with their notes. Some organizations, they didn't keep their notes after they wrote their report. So I have a whole block that I teach on that. And it's really just for that consistency. But number one is that contemporaneous piece. If you do an interview, you have to write it up. You can't write up your notes 3 or 4 weeks later and think you're going to remember things, because you may put things in the report that actually aren't in the notes, but factually occurred. And you're not going to be able to do that if you don't do it contemporaneously. You can't sort of try to go back and re-predict what you thought you heard the person say versus when it's fresh in your head. And I did have that happen in a trial also, where, you know, they were looking at my notes and they were looking at my interview report, and they were like, did you write this up the same day? And I said, look at each one of the interview reports you have, look at each one of the sets of notes you have. And that was one of the things about being I had 9 trials in my career, and 8 criminal and 1 civil, which is a lot in a career in healthcare fraud. And I kept that consistency up. And each time I did a trial or got prepared for a trial, I learned a little bit more about how to do something better or a little bit more streamlined. That was something that was a consistent. You take notes, you write up the report. If it meant that I had to stay late, like super late to write up that report, you just had to do it, because it would bite you in the butt later in the trial.
Yeah, that's great advice. Absolutely. So when we did kind of meet around back in the day for these investigations, I was working at a plan that involved commercial plans, lines of business, as well as Medicare and Medicaid. So maybe for the folks who listen to the podcast, I know we work with a lot of plans of a similar makeup, maybe kind of talk a little bit about how the OIG works with plans like that, and what's the relationship like, and what kind of work are you doing?
Yeah, so obviously the OIG's main focus is fraud, waste, and abuse in the government programs that it's overseeing, and that's primarily Medicare, Medicaid, but there are some 300 different operating divisions within HHS. So you've got things like the NHS, Public Health Service, you know, where the Surgeon General is, Indian Health Services, the FDA is part of all that. But obviously, when your focus is fraud, waste, abuse, and it's mostly, at least in New York and New Jersey, it's Medicare, Medicaid, you've got this intersection of your traditional Medicare and or your Medicare Advantage plans, your Medicaid. And in New Jersey, where I worked most of my career, most of those plans are managed care organizations, Medicaid managed care organizations. So it doesn't really change how you work with them. The difference really is that if you're working strictly something that's Medicare and you're going to the Unified Program Integrity Contractors or the UPICs, you can make all your requests for information or RFIs, or your requests for data, provider applications, all the things that you need for an investigation. You can do that primarily just on a letterhead, on a request for information. When you get into the commercial payers, that's when you need, you know, a subpoena or something like that. I could always have done an RFI to a commercial payer, SIU, strictly for the Medicare Advantage stuff, but then I'm only getting Medicare Advantage stuff. I want everything. So you do that typically with a subpoena, but you know, there's really no difference in that interaction. Oftentimes with the commercial plans, the most difficult thing was if you had a commercial plan that you weren't familiar with, if it wasn't one of the, you know, what they call the BUCAs, right? The Blues, United, Cigna, or Anthem, and you had a contact, it was trying to find that contact was sometimes a little bit of a difficult task. So you'd have to do a little bit more searching, reach out to people who you knew had maybe contacts at those plans. But the process was generally the same. Sometimes the difficulty would be in doing a subpoena for data, is that, you know, the commercial payers maintain their data potentially in different columns or different order of columns than we would get from from the UPICs, or we would pull the data ourselves internally at the OIG. We'd pull the data off of something called 1PI, which, you know, I know you're familiar with, but it's basically the repository of all the claims data that comes in, which Optum is the contractor for that. And then, you know, they take all that data. It's part A, part B, and DME data. Some part C is, I think, sort of sprinkled in there a little bit. But, you know, at the end of the day, you have all this data for Medicare. And then if you went and did a subpoena to a commercial payer for data, sometimes that data wouldn't be, the fields weren't the same. So that was sometimes the challenge, would be to ask the, you know, the commercial payer, hey, can you give me the data and just make sure these fields are there? I mean, typically all of the fields that you want are there, but the difficulty is that if my 1PI data would have, you know, column A was the CPT code, but in the commercial payer, it was column G, you'd have to sort of deal with that. But the process wasn't really any different between commercial or Medicare. The only difference was, from an OIG perspective, there has to be a Medicare or Medicaid hook, meaning there has to be claims that are Medicare, Medicaid. Now, the piece I think that people don't realize is that at the end of the day, there doesn't have to be chargeable Medicare or Medicaid fraud for an OIG agent to stay involved. You just need to have the in, which is that there's an allegation of fraud, waste, and abuse as part of that, where you're bringing the commercial payers in.
You said something in there that I'm going to hone in on, because I think a lot of people, they really need to underscore the value of that, the point of being able to find people in the different plans, and really that networking piece, being able to network with, you know, the OIG, FBI, commercial payers, state, you know, state entities, being able to have that group of people that you can call and talk to and find out who's responsible for what at all the different agencies and private companies. I think that's really important. And a lot of people don't realize the value of networking in this industry.
Yeah, that's probably the most important thing. When I first started, the guy that mentored me, very, very dear friend of mine, who's long retired and has stayed in the industry and is in a very high position in healthcare fraud, waste, and abuse. And he once said to me, it's not what you know, it's at the time, it's how big is your Rolodex. And so for me, my career was really spent upon not so much trying to be a master of everything that I could, because you can't be in healthcare. It's sort of just knowing, it's knowing a little bit about a lot and understanding that interchangeability. You know, it's like if you know anybody who's good with working on cars and they have the ability to say, okay, this piece works on this car and this car, you know, like if you know that, for example, a DeLorean can take an engine from, you know, a Mazda or a Mitsubishi or whatever it is, and you know that interchangeability, and you can have a conversation with one person, that information can typically transgress itself into conversations with other people. And it's just a matter of finding out who those people are. And if you just have a couple of really good contacts, those people tend to know other people. And, you know, it sort of becomes like that old commercial, they'll tell two friends and so on and so on. So it's never about knowing, you just can't know everything. You know, thankfully we've all got the power of the internet in front of us, and that helps us learn a ton about things. And if you're smart enough to sit down and be, it's not really smart, but if you're curious enough that when something new comes your way, you get online, you do a little bit of research on it, and then you go and you try to seek out the people who know a lot about it, and you let them sit and educate you. But yeah, this is as big of an industry as this is also a very small industry. You know, it's like my dad used to always say, be nice to the people you meet on the way up, because you're meeting them on the way down. And there's a lot of truth in that. I mean, the circles are very big and they're sort of concentric. And so you really do have to have the ability to, if you just know a couple of people and you know, before you know it, you'll be able to make contact with anybody that you need in this industry after making it's almost 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon.
That's right. Absolutely. And, for those listening, the reference to the DeLorean, there is one in our house, but it does need a new engine. I will tell you that it's not running right now. So eventually, I have ridden it. And when it was running, it needs a little work. All right. So thinking about your vast career, you know, usually there's a case that just stands out in your mind. Sometimes it's, you know, just the most difficult case. Maybe it's the first case. Is there a case that just stands out in your mind as just one of those stories that you like to tell?
You know, so it depends upon what you're talking about. So, you know, I was very lucky. I got hired at a time where you didn't really have a lot of options on what you were going to work, which was a good thing because you had to have a breadth of experience. And then when I moved to New Jersey, for a large portion of about 8 years of the time I was in New Jersey, about 13 or 14 years, about 8 of those years, I spent working out of the U.S. Attorney's Office out of Newark. And so anything that came in, I jumped at. And at one point, there were only three or four of us in the whole state working everything. So you didn't really have a lot of choice. A lot of OIG agents now can sort of pick and choose cases that they may want to work because there's more resources. So, you know, I got lucky. I got to work a lot of healthcare, traditional healthcare fraud cases, billing for services not rendered, obstruction of audits, you know, sort of documentation parties, a lot of kickback cases. But I guess there's two that stand out. The very first, like, really, really big case I worked involved an ophthalmologist on Staten Island by the name of Carl Frommer. It was a case I worked out of the Eastern District of New York. At the time, Carl Frommer, the resolution wound up being 48 months in jail and about $8 million in restitution and damages. It was a global civil criminal. And it was at that time, it was the second largest case in the country and the largest in Eastern District. And it's, you know, $8 million. That was in 1999 or 2000 or something. And you look back at it now and you think, well, that's nothing, right? And that was a pretty seminal case for me. And it was the very first case I got assigned when I first got out of training. It was not the first case that I had that came to fruition. It's the first case that I had that I got assigned. The provider was considering going to trial and then wound up not, but he was an ophthalmologist on Staten Island. He was billing for doing glaucoma testing and glaucoma treatments on patients that did not have glaucoma. There were patients we believe that actually got what they called the YAG laser or the PI peripheral iridotomy, but they didn't actually have glaucoma. He had an unlicensed doctor from another country working as an optometrist, fabricating the what they call the T pressure, which is the for glaucoma, it's the value of the pressure in the eye. He was fabricating the numbers, putting them on post-its. The doctor was creating notes. Whenever he got audited, he would rewrite the notes. He used the Ativan. He would take like a bunch of Ativan, drink wine, and then go do surgery. I found a patient that was blinded in the surgery. We wound up doing a search warrant of his office. And then went back about a month later and did another search warrant because he kept doing, he was altering records and just creating records out of the ether. And so that one was an important one only because there was the potential of patient harm, but you needed somebody who was just, I mean, he was just billing for whatever he wanted to bill for. In that case, had a little bit of everything. But I think the one case that sort of stands out more than anything else was the one I did that involved a place called Orange Community MRI. There were about 15 people, 14 or 15 ultimately, that were criminally prosecuted. There were about three or four that were through the CMPL process that the OIG does. And that case was a seminal case for me because it was a kickback case that came to us from another doctor who was cooperating, unrelated. And he had an issue involving physical therapy and some other things he was doing in his office and his cooperation. He comes into the U.S. Attorney's office and in his first day of cooperating, he said, well, you know, I got solicited the other day by so-and-so for referring my patients to Orange MRI. Are you guys interested in that? And we were like, yeah. He's like, well, I have this bag of money that they dropped off to me. And the next day he shows up and it's $10,000 in cash. And, he cooperated and it was sort of your textbook of how to work a kickback case. And meaning that, you know, I got the doc to cooperate, he flipped. We did recordings with the sales rep that he dealt with, who was this woman that worked there. I got her on video making kickback payments, having discussions with the doctor. I went to her, I flipped her. She got the money from another sales rep who was sort of the intermediary between the doctor that owned the MRI center and her. I flipped him. He wound up being a major cooperator. He was paying all of the kickbacks and disseminating out the money. And as a result of him, I got him to flip the operations manager who flipped on the doctor. And, you know, we did recordings against 15 or 16 different doctors. Two of them went to trial. I mean, we had him on video taking the kickbacks and towards the, you know, we did two or three recordings and it got to a point where I was actually having my cooperator just walk in and hand the cash to the doctors, not even in an envelope, like, let's just have these conversations. And we had two people go to trial. We picked a bad jury. We had a hung jury on one, even though there was video, but on the retry, I think the jury deliberated for under an hour. In the other trial, it was under an hour, but it was a great case. It was 15 defendants. It was a lot of work. And you know, ultimately it was over a 3-month period. We were out making these payments to these 15 docs. You know, we were doing 2-3 a day every couple of weeks. The calculations, I had 2 really great AUSAs that have left as well that I'm still very close to. It was a great case. We had over 14 months, it was 3 trials. These trials should have been probably a week to a week and a half each. The defense attorneys were very combative, to say the least. Each trial lasted anywhere between, I think, 6 and 8 weeks, which should have been a week-long trial. They just lasted so long. And so for a 14-month period, I was either on trial or preparing for trial. And you know, for anybody who's listening to these podcasts that doesn't understand that, when you're preparing for a trial, it's 7 days a week. It's morning, noon, and night. It's preparing witnesses. It's looking at documents. It's prosecutors telling you what they want. There's no discussion. There's no debate. They want things, you get them. And you're doing that for probably 6 or 8 weeks to the ramp up of the trial. And then the trial goes on all day, and then you go back and you reconvene at the end of the day, and you know, you're dealing with things until 11 o'clock at night. And that goes on, you know, so that went on for the 2 months before the trial, then the 6 weeks, and then you get a little bit of a break, and then it starts up again. But it was a good result. I got, you know, there were, I think, 15 criminal prosecutions, about 3 administrative through the CMP process. Nearly every doctor went to jail, at least for a small amount of time. One doc owned an adult medical daycare with his wife, and another person took his name off of the bank accounts, sold, in air quotes, sold the shares of his practice portion to his wife, got out of jail, put his name right back on the bank account, went right back to it as if he never left. So, you know, I got 2 bites at the apple there. That was an odd one because that doesn't normally happen, but, you know, he went to jail, got out, was on supervised release, was excluded, and went back to the adult medical daycare, telling people how to do business. It was crazy, but
that is crazy.
Yeah, it was crazy. So those are the 2 I think that, you know, that stand out. You know, one at least from the patient care and sort of just the level of nonsense that the first guy did, and the second one just from the sheer, you know, of my 9 trials or 8 or 9 trials, that was 3 of them were all at the same case, so essentially the same witnesses, essentially the same testimony. But the one defendant in that case, his lawyer actually called me as a witness, which is crazy, like that just never happens. But the defense attorney called me on the stand as a witness, which meant that the U.S. Attorney's office, the AUSA, got to cross-examine me, which means that the AUSA gets to throw all of the softball questions about things that the defense attorney didn't ask, which are the really incriminating things. So there were some bizarre things. The trial judge was a very, very nice judge, but it was her first trial ever. She was a brand new judge, had never tried a case. And so she had really good command of the law. She was super nice, but she basically let everybody have their say. You know, I've had other trials with other judges, and they really, you know, keep a very tight ship on things. This judge just kind of let things go a little bit, which added to the 6 weeks of pain that it caused.
That sounds like fun. So you've seen a lot, obviously. So a lot of different scenarios, patient harm, kickbacks, you know, services not rendered. So with all of that, how would you say the landscape of fraud, waste, and abuse has changed, if at all?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. And I have this conversation with a lot of people about the fact that I say it's the same circus, it's just different clowns. And so, you know, the schemes sort of percolate into each other. The landscape, I think, from an investigative perspective, the landscape is changing because investigators have greater tools at their disposal. You know, and everybody talks about data analytics, and everybody talks about AI. And I have another podcast I do, Coffee Compliance and Chuckleheads. And we talked about, in our last episode, we talked about AI, and there's nothing really automated. You still need to have a subject matter expert to be able to do things like look at false positives and things of that sort. You know, you know, just in the stuff that you guys do at Healthcare Fraud Shield, you can't just rely on the data. You've got to have somebody who's being in a, who's in a position to say, this is, something doesn't look right, or hey, maybe there's a reason for this, and you have to be able to ferret these out. So from the investigative side, data analytics are getting better each day, but I still think there's a lot, obviously a lot to be done. I just had a conversation with someone who's a professor of law at Seton Hall in their healthcare, and we were talking about some of the data things out there. And his question that he kept coming back to is, why isn't there something to stop this? Like, you know, we're talking about the fraud triangle, prescriber, doctor, the prescriber, patient, supplier, whether it be DME, whether it be prescriptions, whether it be some other ancillary service or product or item. Like, why isn't that stuff just stopped? When the doctor is in California, the patient's in New York, and the pharmacy is in Florida, like, why isn't that just stopped immediately? And I was, well, that's a great question. I'd love to put you in touch with people who can give you some purview into that. I wonder it myself, but I think that from a landscape perspective for the bad guys, it's finding the old ways, the new schemes for old things. So it's, you know, that everybody talks about all of the telemedicine fraud, and I think that does a disservice to doctors who do actual telemedicine, because it's really telemarketing fraud. And I think that's really, you know, everybody talks about it as telehealth fraud, but it's really a bunch of people. I think if you took the telemedicine fraud schemes and you parallel them to the pump and dump schemes of the 80s and early 90s for stock, how is that really any different? It's a bunch of people in a room making phone calls. Instead of telling you that they have a great stock for you, it's telling you what they can do for your pain, but it's the same sort of thing. So that doesn't really change. So I think where the landscape changes is a little bit in with how providers who weren't doing certain things are now doing certain things. So, you know, one of the big things are these foot bath schemes that are out there now with podiatrists, right? So, you know, podiatrists were typically involved in fraud involving circumventing the 61-day rule. I did so many podiatry cases that you know, I just got so good at doing them. And the schemes were all the same. It was circumventing the 61-day rule, circulating the codes, the modifier 25 fraud, which is always out there and is never going away. And now you hear that podiatrists are now moving into these other schemes with foot baths and things of that sort. And so the landscape changes because the people that were doing the fraud previously and they can't seem to get that fraud through are going to find ways to percolate into other things. So, you know, were podiatrists traditionally writing a lot of prescriptions? No, but now they are. And now they're doing it for things that are just kind of bizarro, you know, medications. So I think where the landscape changes is that providers start to find new ways to do old things that others may have already done, and that, you know, was maybe semi-successful for them. But I think that the staples are always going to be there, right? Modifier 25 continues to be a major problem in the healthcare industry. I think it's a huge problem in podiatry. I'm actually going to be talking to somebody in my own podcast about it. But I think that, you know, whether it's, and when you talk about it, it's not necessarily fraud, waste, or abuse. It's really more on the waste abuse, right? Unless if you're intent on doing something fraudulent, then education and training and outliers and notifying people that they're outliers, those aren't going to change those behaviors if you're intent on committing fraud, you're intent on committing fraud. But I think the landscape is going to change in part, always going to be changing in part because we, at least on the provider, on the payer side rather, whether it be CMS, Medicaid, or your commercial payers, they're always a little bit behind the eight ball because we don't know what the bad guys are thinking until they've already thought it and executed it, and then it hits something. You know, there are probably, for every provider that we catch, there's a provider out there that's just under the radar that you'll never know is doing X, Y, and Z unless they come forward and do a self-disclosure or something like that, or just move on. But you're not going to see that unless, you know, there's some sort of ability to read the mind of a criminal.
Absolutely. So let's kind of talk about this might be one or two more questions. So we've talked about kind of where things have changed. You know, you even addressed some of the challenges in the industry. If you had a wish list for, you know, folks who do what we do, to make it easier to, you know, catch those ones that are flying under the radar, what do you think we could do as an industry, or where do you think we should continue to take this, you know, whether it's increased analytics, technology, what are your thoughts on where we need to be?
Yeah, well, so my intellectual property requires me to tell you that I need to charge you an hour for each of these things. But look, I think generally speaking, the wish list is for investigators is always going to be the same. It's real-time data, mm-hmm. right? So looking at data that's 2 years old and telling me what my trend is from something 2 years ago does nothing for me. It just does nothing for me. If I'm the director of an SIU or I'm an OIG agent, I don't want to know what happened in 2018. I need to know what's happening today. If a provider's billings are an outlier, I don't need to know that they were an outlier in 2018. I need to know they're an outlier now. And so I think real time or close to real time, and there's actual definitions for real time and close to real time, you know, in some of the regulatory language out there, particularly I think with the PDMP, right? That stuff needs to be real time. If you have a doctor who's a terrible outlier on whatever it is that they're prescribing, you know, people need to know that in more real time. So that's number one on the wish list. Number two on my wish list is training. I think that within an organization, there has to be a standard. You know, we talk about documentations, and we did some training here at Advise a little bit ago for a pretty large SIU. I think there were 20 investigators that I did the training for. And I asked them the same question about documentation. How many of you handwrite your notes? And, you know, a lot of them did. I said, okay, what do you do once you get done with them? And there were probably about four different answers to what they did. And I just said, well, you've got to have one answer. And whatever that one answer, I can't tell you what it is. I can give you options. It's ultimately up to the decision of whoever it is that's the leader of the organization. But whatever that answer is, that one answer, everybody has to do it, because if it's inconsistent, then none of it's right. You know, it's sort of like if there's two sets of books, which is the right set of books, which is the wrong set of books? Well, it doesn't matter. They're both wrong. You know, I mean, there's, you know, if you've got two sets of anything and you say, this is the official record of X, this is our working record of X. Well, guess what? Neither one of them are a record, because you can't show definitively that every single one of those is the same. So it's really, it's real-time data, it's training. I think the problem, and it's a little bit of the training problem, comes down to that if you're bringing in people who spent 20 or 30 years as a homicide detective, and they may be, and that's amazing, right? But now you're moving from one type of thing to a white collar position where the vernacular is different, the lingo is different. And I always like to say to the lawyers I work with, I speak both healthcare and legalese. And that's an important piece. So it's understanding that vernacular and being able to speak in those terms. So those are the two that stand out the most, is that I think SIUs, they give a lot of training, but do they give the right kind of training? Like sending someone to the NHCAA is amazing. You know, I was on the faculty like you were, and I did stuff for NHCA for 20 plus years, and it's great. And the presentations are great, and sending people to that is phenomenal. But if you're sending four people and you have a team of 20 and you're learning the newest and latest and greatest schemes, which is great, but does everybody in your unit, do they take notes in a similar fashion? Do they treat their notes the same way? Do they store their notes in the same way? Is everybody using the same template for writing up an interview report? When a referral is made, have you coordinated what a referral should look like with whoever it is you're making that referral to? Like, you know, the OIG, we would meet constantly with the UPICs and say, this is what we want to see in a referral. You know, I don't need your 80-page accurate report. The 80-page accurate report doesn't help me. I can run accurate myself. I just need to know what the information is. Sending me a, you know, we used to get them in hard copy, and there'd be these like, you know, bound volumes of stuff. And there would be a lot of really good information, but it would be buried in an 80-page accurate report, you know, because that was in there. I don't really care about the accurate report. So that's, you know, I think it's part of it. I think, you know, it's real-time data, it's training. And I think it's having the ability to have people who can be there to vet your false positives. You need someone who has that subject matter expertise to be able to say, you know, I'm not really sure about this. I get that this person is an outlier, but let's try to do a little bit of vetting and see why. You know, all ophthalmologists are not the same, but they're treated the same for peer comparisons. Well, if you're a retinal specialist and you spend your day doing tests or procedures that are specific to things like macular degeneration or retinal detachment, how can you be compared to a general ophthalmologist who does none of that? And then you stand that as a potential outlier. So you need to have, that has to be built in somehow, whether that's another level of analytics, or if it's just having a subject matter expert to say, hey, have you thought about looking at this? You know, what's their subspecialty or whatever? So.
No, that's great. Great points. Great advice. I completely agree with all of your wish list items. It's a fabulous and interesting industry. I'm so grateful to be a part of it and to have met people like yourself and continuing that networking as we do. So I cannot thank you enough for being a part of our podcast today. Why don't you let everyone know where they can find you, because you're doing a lot of different things yourself. And so, yeah, give everyone an idea of where they can find you and what you can do.
Sure. Yeah. So we're on the web. We've got a couple of different websites. We've got Advise with a Z, A-D-V-I-Z-E, Health, H-E-A-L-T-H, oneword.com. That's our main website for sort of the consulting and advisory work that's out there in the typically on the provider or the payer space, really. And then there's Advise Legal, A-D-V-I-Z-E, Legal, L-E-G-A-L.com. That's really the side that I deal with. For the most part. And we have another website that should be launching this week, and that's advise.consulting. And that's for all of the IT security services that we do. And we obviously focus on healthcare, but we've got some people that are high trust people and HIPAA certified and IT security assessments and pen testing and all of that. So those are the three websites. And you can get me at my email, which is erubenstein@advisehealth.com, and it's E-R-U-B-E-N-S-T-E-I-N at advisehealth.com.
All right. Well, thank you, Eric. I really appreciate your time today. It's always good to talk to you. And any parting words, maybe you'll take your ride in the DeLorean when it's fixed.
I can only be so lucky. I appreciate being on. You know, I'm doing a lot of podcasts myself and talking to people every day. I really do like you. Live and breathe and think about healthcare fraud all the time. But, you know, I guess in my retirement age, my parting thought is that right is right and wrong is wrong. And it's still the same when I retired. And, you know, I've done work on behalf of providers who the government has charged, I think, overly. And I've done work for providers who I think were not getting necessarily a fair shake from the government. At the end of the day, right is right, wrong is wrong. And it's just really, if there's something that needs to be rectified, it's a matter of rectifying it in the appropriate manner. Prisons are not necessarily made for every doctor or healthcare provider that commits a fraud. And I think that there's a very big misnomer in the manner in which that is done. And that's obviously a conversation for another day. It's an apolitical statement, but I just think that when we're looking at fraud, waste, and abuse, everybody has to sort of take a bite of that apple. The payers need to have really good, strong policies in place. Providers need to have really good, strong compliance plans and policies in place. And the public needs to understand that just because you don't pay for something and there's no out-of-pocket because there's no co-payment or co-insurance, that it still matters, even if it's still not something that you got or didn't ask for.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Again, everyone's got Eric's contact information, verbally anyway. I'll make sure I'll put it out there for you as well. And I look forward to speaking with you again. Thank you, Eric. We'll be right back.